thank you all for being here this morning. It's been encouraging so far. Really appreciate the Bible classes. We had a great class in the auditorium going through more of Genesis. And really appreciate the songs that have been led and the prayers that have been offered. Everyone here does such a great job offering very thoughtful prayers. And I think today has been an example of that. Thank you guys for doing that. If you would, open up your Old Testaments to Daniel. And we're going to be looking at chapter 3. Earlier last week, I was in a study with someone. And as we were going through Daniel 3, I thought, you know, there are some points here that just, they touch on so many things that have been going on. Things that have been going on in the world around us, things that have been going on in some of our families, some of the things that we're facing. I thought, you know, Daniel 3. We're going to go through Daniel 3 today. So I hope that it's helpful. We're all familiar with Daniel, and especially Daniel 3. We looked at this in our VBS just last summer. But I'd like us to talk about trusting God through the fire. Daniel 3 is that chapter in Daniel where his three Hebrew friends are put to the test. Their faith is put to the test. They do a remarkable job trusting in God despite the consequence of being thrown into this superheated furnace. And not knowing what will happen, they go into the furnace. And I think there's just some really helpful lessons as we compare what they went through with some of the things that we go through. I personally have never been threatened with being thrown into a furnace. That has not happened yet. I'm sure there will come a time when someone says, that sermon was horrible, to the furnace. I've seen fires. I've seen accidental fires. Just last night, I was visiting with a family who had an accidental yard fire yesterday afternoon, where they were having a little brush fire, and one of their children was trying to help and placed a pile of cardboard into it while the dad's back was turned. And when they turned back around, the yard was on fire. And there was a field right next door, and they were calling the fire department. And I saw pictures, and that just, like, they created a family memory right there. But I've never had to face what they faced. But all of us face trials. All of us face trials that we could compare to facing a fire. You know, we have the potential of being persecuted over our faith. That's more and more likely in the culture and the country that we live in. That's more and more likely. We have trials of living in a broken world where we experience death and decay and accidents and things like that, where it's not necessarily anybody's fault that things happen, but that's a trial and that's a difficulty. There are some times where we face difficulties because of foolish or sinful choices that we've made. And those things are hard. And so as we think about that and what trial you may be facing, let's think about Daniel chapter 3 and some of the lessons that we can learn from it. Really quick, let's summarize the story. You know, early in Nebuchadnezzar's reign, in the first couple of verses of Daniel 3, he decides to build and set up this image of gold. And we're not exactly sure what the image looked like. It was approximately 10 feet wide at the base and approximately 90 feet tall, so about as tall as a 9-story building. And there are people that think that it was just a 90-foot-tall statue. That's possible. The problem with that is the dimensions don't work at all. Like, it would be really hard to engineer something like that. Some people think it was more along the lines of something like the Washington Monument in D.C., where you have this pillar that goes up, and on the top of it, you have an image of a person. And the whole thing, whatever it was, the whole thing is overlaid in gold. We're told that Nebuchadnezzar set it up in the plain of Dura. So the idea is, in this low spot that everyone can see from miles around, we have this elevated thing gleaming in the sun. Everyone can see it. And you think about when you drive through state capitals. Sometimes on the top of their capitol building, they will have a gleaming gold statue of something to catch your eye, whether it's a founder of the community or some historical figure. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar has constructed. And then what he does is he sends out a proclamation that he's going to start playing music at a certain time. And every time you hear this music, everyone is supposed to fall down, and his instruction is very clear. We'll talk about it some more in a minute. But his instruction is really clear. Everyone is supposed to fall down and worship the image. Everybody is supposed to be acknowledging Nebuchadnezzar. Well, that's a problem. That's a problem if your faith is monotheistic, if you believe that there is only one God. That's a problem. And it's a problem if your one God has told you, don't worship or bow down to anything else other than me. And so they're presented with a conflict. How are they going to respond to this? And when you get down to the next section of the story, starting in verse 8, at that time there was a group of men that we learn throughout the book were very jealous. They were very jealous of these Hebrew young men. They were hostile. They played political games and manipulated, and they were not straightforward. They were just immoral men. And what these men did is they came to the king and said, hey, didn't you tell us to do something? And they set it up. Didn't you tell us to do something? When we hear this music, aren't we sort of supposed to like bow down? And Nebuchadnezzar confirmed, yes, that's what's supposed to happen. And I went, oh, right. Okay, well, by the way, there's a group of men, Daniel, Shadrach, you know, Meshach and Abednego, these guys that are not doing it. And the way they refer to them in verse 12 is actually derogatory. They say certain Jews. They don't start off by naming them. They start off by talking about their ethnicity. They don't acknowledge their title. At the end of chapter 2, these men had just been promoted. And so they're actually showing disrespect. They don't refer to them by name. They don't refer to them by title. They refer to them by their ethnicity. These certain Jews. And you look at verse 12 and what they say. These men, O king, they say three things. They pay no attention to you. They don't serve your gods. And they don't worship the golden image that you've set up. The first one is just flat out not true. They pay attention. I mean, that's why he promoted them, is because they're good at what they do. They pay attention to details. Now, the other two are true. They don't serve the gods of the Babylonians, and they don't bow down before this image. And you remember what the command was. If anybody doesn't listen to me, into the furnace. What Nebuchadnezzar does, he gets angry in verse 13. But instead of commanding that they go straight to the fire, he brings them to him and gives them a second chance. He confirms, are you guys really not bowing down? You know, and if there was like wax in your ears or something, like, we'll do it again. I'll strike up the music right now and you guys can prove your loyalty. And when you get to verses 16 and 17, you get to the pinnacle of the chapter. The chapter is broken down into seven paragraphs. And verses 16 through 18 are they're the central paragraph. They are the main point of the whole chapter. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Just such a profound, simple profession of faith and what they're going to do because of their faith. And you know the story. Nebuchadnezzar is filled with fury. Again, the idea is he's filled with furious rage of fury. Like, it's trying to emphasize how emotionally worked up Nebuchadnezzar is over this. His expression changes. And he's so upset. He says, superheat that thing, seven times hotter than normal. And when they go to throw them in, the men who take them fall over dead. And you know how it ends. They go into the fire. The ropes are consumed by the fire. But Nebuchadnezzar looks in and sees an angel in there. Asks them to come out. Their clothes don't even smell like smoke. And Nebuchadnezzar ends up praising the God of these three men. How did they do that? How did they face that trial? How did they make that profession of faith? I think verse 28 is where I'd like us to spend the rest of our time and see what we can copy from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Look at verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. And I think what Nebuchadnezzar says there in verse 28 gives us three or four things that we can learn and copy as we face whatever it is that we're facing, as we work through whatever it is we're working through. The first thing that he says is, after God delivered these young men, in verse 28, is that they trusted in him. They trusted in him. They trusted that God was good and that God was in control. You go back to their statement of faith in verses 16 through 18. They don't know what God is going to do. But they use a word that's important in Judaism. And it's in response to a challenge that Nebuchadnezzar gave as he gave them their second opportunity to worship. At the end of verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar, after offering them the second opportunity, says, "Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" I mean, he's throwing down the gauntlet. Look, I'm being super gracious to you, and if you don't listen, there is no one who's going to stop me from hurting you. No one can deliver you. And that word is the significant word. Because in verse 17, their response is, "Our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand. But if not, be it known to you." They go back to this word, deliver. That word is significant in Judaism. As you go back through your Old Testament, that word is the word that God used in Exodus to describe what he did in delivering them from Egypt and delivering them from Pharaoh. In Exodus 6:6, "Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery." That's what God promised he would do. Prior to his death, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, as Moses was trying to remind all the Israelites what kind of God he was, in verse 34, he asked a rhetorical question. He said, "Has any God ever attempted to go and take a nation for himself out of the midst of another nation? By trials, signs, by wonders, and by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, by great deeds of terror, all of which the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes." He's recounting the deliverance out of Egypt. It was deliverers that they were missing and that they were longing for in Judges. And you can go through the book of Judges and the word deliverer. They were looking for a deliverer. And then when you get to Exodus chapter 20 and you start going through the Ten Commandments, do you realize how God referred to himself? In Exodus 20 and verse 2, he said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." God describes himself as, "I'm that deliverer. I'm the deliverer." Someone had a really neat quote to kind of summarize this idea. God entered into the historical situation of his people and delivered them from bondage. That's the God of the Bible. Where God would see what was going on and at the right time, in the right way, would deliver. And sometimes he delivered through miraculous signs. Sometimes he delivered through a human being, a representative in a judge or a king. But the idea is, God is a God who delivers. So when you come back to Daniel 3, and Nebuchadnezzar says, "Well, I mean, who's the God that can deliver?" The three young men know all of this. They know all of this history. And they say, "Our God corners the market on deliverance. Our God is able to deliver." Now, whether he will, we don't know. Man, to have faith like that. To have faith like that. To choose to trust what you know God has revealed himself to be. You know, we all wrestle with that. Someone gave the illustration of kids learning to play baseball or softball. Especially kids who are afraid of the ball. you know, they go up to bat and the ball gets thrown and the coaches are trying to teach them to step in or lean in because they want to pull back and pull away, and it makes it next to impossible to connect. And so despite their natural inclination to avoid a projectile moving at them quickly, the coach is trying to tell them, trust me, this is the way it works. You've got to lean in, you've got to swing, you've got to stay right there, and they need to trust the instruction and the experience of the coach. And that takes time. That takes time. And that's us with God, where God gives us instruction, God gives us warnings, God gives us hope, and it's just so counterintuitive, but we look back, can I trust what God has said? And God's just saying, lean in. Just lean in. We want to trust in the goodness and the sovereignty of God. He's good and He's in control, even when we don't know what's going on. But that's okay, because I am not in control. I couldn't change these things. They could not change what was about to happen to them. They maintained their trust in God. That's not all. If we go back to Daniel 3 and verse 28, what Nebuchadnezzar observed, he said that they trusted in him, and then I'm reading from the ESV, it says that they set aside the king's command. That's a pretty brash thing to do. I mean, the accusation that the antagonists had back in verse 12 was, they don't pay any attention to you. Well, actually, yes, they do. It was an intentional decision. They clearly heard. It was not a mistake. They heard the musical instruments just like everybody else in that plane. But they made a decision to set aside what the king said to do. And I want to share some of the other Bible translations and how they explain that phrase. The ESV says they set aside the king's command. The New Living Translation says they defied the king's command. The King James says they changed the king's word. New King James says they frustrated it. Another version says they violated the king's command. I mean, it's all of them, all of those synonyms are saying the same thing. They made an intentional decision to disobey what they were told to do. Why did they do that? Why did they do that? And what I would suggest is this. They did that because they trusted what God had said about the matter. They trusted what God had already said about bowing down and worshiping idols. This is what they had to do. They had to take what they knew God's word said and what the king said and compare them and decide, which one do I follow? Which one do I follow? Because when you go to the king's command, this is what he said. When you hear every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image. I mean, those phrases are repeated throughout the chapter. Image is used 11 times. The idea of falling down is recounted 3 times. The idea that this was a man-made image and set up, it was set up and set up and set up by Nebuchadnezzar is used 9 times. Worshipping it is mentioned. It's clear. We're talking about idolatry. That's what we're talking about. But what they know is they know that God had given a command over in Exodus chapter 20. That you shall not make for yourself a carved image, and you shall not bow down to them or serve them. And so they had to weigh out. This is what the king is telling us to do, but this is what God's word tells us to do. God wins. God wins. I'm going to trust what God has said about this, even though it's going to make life hard for me right now. I'm going to trust what God says over what the king says. You know, Matt made reference to this in the devotion on Wednesday. And I think it's appropriate. One of the ways our culture is doing that right now is when we're trying to say, when is a person a person? When does life start? This is what our culture says. This is what God's word says. If you're like me and if you're like Matt, you're reading up on that. I mean, what kind of ramifications does what New York just did have for everybody else? What kind of precedent does it set? What does it say about the young people in our country and how they view life? And what was horrifying was there was someone who quoted a statistic that in New York, that this decision in New York had nothing to do with making abortion more available, because New York has the highest abortion rate in the country. 1 out of every 3 pregnancies ends in abortion in New York. And that blows my mind. I mean, you just think about our personal family. I've had 6 children. That means 2 out of my 6 would have been aborted. Just, that is a crazy high number. And this decision was not made in New York to make it more available or accessible to people. It wasn't to save lives. People who are being objective are explaining that decision was made to make a statement that there's a group of people that are done having this discussion about when life starts. And their assessment is life starts when you say you want it to start. That's their decision. That is horrible. That's horrible. What does God say about that? As you compare what man is saying, what does God say about that? And you have the beautiful poetic language of David in Psalm 139:14, where he's describing in poetic form how God knits together a body in the womb. It clearly implies life and personhood before birth. Or in Luke chapter 1, when you have Mary and Elizabeth interacting with each other as they're carrying John and Jesus, and John leaps in the womb and Elizabeth makes comment of that. And this is more pertinent to the law that just got passed in New York. In Exodus 21, as you go down through the Levitical laws, Levitical law held people accountable for wounding a pregnant woman and causing her to miscarry. The concept is life for life. So if you take a life or cause the loss of life inside of a pregnant woman, even if the woman survives, it was seen as murder. You murdered somebody and you were held accountable for that. Because of the passing of this one law, New York has had to go back through and change all of their other laws. You will no longer be penalized for murder for causing a pregnant woman to lose her child. You can't, because they don't see it as a life. That's horrible. That's horrible. And that's just one example of how this process works. We need to be going through our lives where we're trying to evaluate, this is what the world says, this is what man says, this is what I'm being told to do, but what does God say? And despite the consequences or the ramifications, in faith, I'm going to trust God. I'm going to trust what God has to say about that. That's what these young men did. They trusted what God had said about it. And then you go back to Daniel chapter 3 and verse 28. They trusted in him, they set aside the king's command, and they yielded up their bodies. They yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own. I think there are two points that we can make about this. You realize the first thing that they're thinking about is, what's going to happen to me? What is about to happen? And they've already told the king, we don't know what God's going to do. We have no way of knowing. But what you're telling me is, if I stay here and I refuse to do what you're telling me to do, then my immediate future looks like this. My immediate future is, you're going to tie me up, you're going to bind me, and you're going to throw me in to get roasted. And you know what they do? They trust God with their future. They don't know what's going to happen. But they believe in an omnipotent, omnipresent God. An omniscient God who does know. He's already in the future. He already knows what's going to happen with this. And they're going to place their trust in Him. I mean, that's what faith does. You think about all of the examples in Hebrews 11 that we're going to be looking at as we go through the course of this year. All of those people, they did not know what was going to happen. But they trusted God with what would happen. I'm going to put my faith in Him because He knows and He's there. And I'm just going to choose to keep going. I'm going to choose to follow Him. When I was graduating from high school, I started getting the typical graduation gifts. you know, you start getting the cards in the mail and the open house and things like that. And I had an uncle that lived in California at the time. And he sent a package. I didn't know it was coming. And it was more than just a card. It was a package. And so I opened it up, and inside was a t-shirt, and it had the most cliche thing on it. But it was so appropriate. And the cliche thing that the t-shirt said was, "I don't know what the future holds, but I know who holds the future." I'm like, man, that should go on a poster with a kitten. You know? But it was right. It was right. I mean, I wore that thing till it fell apart. I had no idea what I was going to do in the next 12 months, let alone the next 3 months. You know, this, I had no idea what my life was going to turn out to be like. I still don't, beyond today. But I believe there's a God who does. There's a God who does know the future. And so if I trust in what He says, even though I don't know the outcomes, I'm going to trust God with that. I'm going to trust God with that. He knows what's best. I'm going to trust God with the future. And then the second thing that is just like, it's so obvious we probably don't even need to say it, but we're going to say it. When you go back to 3:28 and it talks about them yielding up their bodies, it's talking about them being willing to sacrifice themselves. Literally, they are letting their bodies potentially be consumed by fire. And I think the thing that's just so obvious is they're trusting God even when it's hard. Trusting God when it's easy is not trust. It's you agreeing with God and you're like, hey, I know what God knows and this is great. This is easy. Trust is when you don't know. And it's hard. It's hard. It's when you're facing difficult circumstances. It's when it's unknown. It's when there's pressure. It's when there's risk. And you're going to choose to put your trust in God. We're going to trust Him through my circumstances. It ties in so well with so many things that we said in the adult Bible class this morning about all of these patriarchs who went through all these difficult things. And they had happy things happen too. But they had some difficult things happen. But their trust and their faith grew when it was tested and the pressure was on. Paul talks about that over in Romans chapter 5, verses 3 and 4. Paul talks about this. Not only that, we rejoice in our sufferings, these times of pressure and trial, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. That moments like this are productive. They're a part of a refining process that God's putting His people through. And it makes them better. It makes them more Christ-like when we respond with trust, when we respond with faith. You know, one of the favorite examples that I can think of endurance and trusting even when it's hard and following through, I love Tolkien. I love Tolkien. I love his books. I love The Lord of the Rings. Like, once every 18 months, I'll watch the video series, extended version. I'll fall asleep halfway through them now. But they're great. And you've got these two characters that are intentionally made to be smaller and weaker and more vulnerable than any other character. They're not super strong. Frankly, they're not that smart. But they're the ones that endure to the end and help each other endure to the end, even when they realize this is the end. Like, when we started this thing, we thought we were going to finish and come home. But the closer they got, there was no hope of coming home. It wasn't there. But they did what was right. And they endured. And they grew through it. And that's us. That's us. We don't know what the future will hold. But we trust in God's goodness and His control that He's making us more like Jesus through this process. And so we trust Him even when things are hard. And I want you to notice that how Daniel chapter 3 ends. Look at the last couple of verses of the chapter. Verses 29 and 30. Nebuchadnezzar, after acknowledging what these men have done, said, "Therefore I make a decree. Any people nation or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. 2 points. As we conclude, let's make 2 points from these verses. First, when Nebuchadnezzar called the men out, in verse 26, he referred to them as servants of the Most High God. And in the book of Daniel, that's the first time that that title is used for God. And then it's used 12 other times. It's used a total of 13 times in the book. This is not just the God of the Israelites. This is not just the God of the three men. This is God Most High. You see Nebuchadnezzar's concept of God grow through the book. You see his faith increase. You see, when we trust God through difficult circumstances, it helps other people realize things about God. It helps them learn things about God. Because they're sitting there going, why would anyone, after being given a second chance, choose fire over kneeling down for 30 seconds? Who would do that? Someone who believes in the Most High God would do that. And then you add to it that in this section of Daniel, Daniel's such a unique book. It's written in two different languages. Most of it is written in Hebrew, but there's this section that's written in Aramaic. And the thought is that these sections, it's like section 2 through about 6, that it was written in Aramaic, and you have these proclamations by the king, and it's being sent out to the entire empire. So it's not just that Nebuchadnezzar is learning things about God through their trust. The entire Babylonian empire is learning something about the God Most High through their trust. I mean, is it good for you and your relationship with God to trust? Yes. 100% yes. But it has an effect, an evangelistic effect on others when they see us trust in Him through hard things. When they see us weigh, this is what God says, and I don't, you know, sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't, but it doesn't match up with what y'all are saying, and I know what y'all may think of me, but I'm going to choose God. That brings glory to God. That brings glory to God. And when you don't know what's going to happen by trusting in Him, you still do it. And especially when it's difficult. We could summarize all of that. I think what we're being charged to do is to believe in the sovereignty and goodness of God and faithfully face the trials He's leading you through. There's a beautiful song. There's a beautiful song that is trying to communicate that idea. It's called When You Say Go. When you say go, we will go. When you say wait, we will wait. When you say step out on the water, we will come. When you call us to the fire, we will place our eyes on you. That's the idea. Even though I see that what God has in front of me right now is something hard and something difficult and it's a trial and it's not going to be fun, that's what God has put in front of me. And it's okay because God is there and He has a purpose in it. And so I will walk toward it. I'll walk toward it. And it's okay to communicate it's hard. It's okay to communicate it's difficult. It's okay to say it's not fair. That's okay. That's all right. Job did that up to a point and was still okay with what he was saying. David does it in the Psalms. But at the end, after you've shared with God how it makes you feel, you put your foot in front of the other and you go. If you're not a Christian yet, we have even more reason to trust in God's goodness and in God's sovereignty. We're on the other side of the cross. We have so much more record of what God has done to step into history and deliver His people. And so if you've not yet been delivered from sin and death by the sacrifice of Jesus, by placing your faith in Him as the Son of God and being baptized into Him, you can do that this morning. And for those of us who have already become Christians, This is part of our walk until Christ comes back. Learning to trust more and more. And I hope you've been as encouraged by Daniel 3 as I was when I was reading through it last week. If there's someone going through something that they would like for prayers of encouragement as they go through whatever trial, whatever fire they're being called to, let us know, because we want to come alongside you and walk through that with you. Whatever we can do to help, come forward and let us know while we stand and while we sing.